rain that fell this morning was enough to knock the fire down, but certainly not enough to put it out.
Wet weather is slowing the Funny River fire. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Tuesday, May 27th. Good evening, I'm Ellen Lockyer. Also tonight, the Coast Guard Admiral talks about plans to handle increasing activity in the Arctic.
People ask me all the time, what investments are we going to make? Are we going to build a hangar up in Barrow and a forward operating facility? And I'm like, if we need to, but we don't know if we need one until we know what's out there and what the play is going to look like.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by First National Bank Alaska, earning Alaska's trust for more than 90 years. Learn more at fnbalaska.com. Equal housing lender, member FDIC. The Medallion Foundation and Federal Aviation Administration set standards for the operation of aircraft and airports. More information at faa.gov/go/flyalaska. This message is sponsored by the Medallion Foundation.
The Funny River fire has grown to more than 182,000 acres. After a streak of warm, dry weather, firefighters are getting a break, with rain falling today during the early morning hours and temperatures in the 50s. Rob Allen is the incident commander for the Funny River fire.
The rain that fell this morning was enough to knock the fire down, but certainly not enough to put it out.
Officials say the weather pattern should hold for at least the next few days. Scott Berg is a forecaster with the National Weather Service.
We're going to see waves of precipitation as they move up through Cook Inlet, on up into our area, and then up into the Matsu Valley. And that should help quite a bit with kind of keeping everything calmed down.
Allen says there has been enough rain to dampen the grass, which should keep the fire from spotting and creeping ahead, but it will take quite a bit more rain to affect the black spruce, which has been one of the fire's main fuels.
Normally, we look at, you know, 3 days of good rain in a row. Anytime you get a break in that and there's some sun that comes out, the grasses will dry incredibly fast, the rest of the fine fuels will dry really fast, and then you're back over, start at stirrup one.
So far, 5 structures have been lost in the fire, 1 outbuilding and 4 recreational cabins. None of the structures were accessible by road. There are currently 689 personnel working on the fire. The fire management team lifted the evacuation order this morning for Funny River Road from mile 7 to the end. The road remains under an evacuation alert, which means residents should be ready to leave again if the fire gets worse. For the last few days, residents have been staying in RVs, tents, and shelters. KBBI's Shady Grove Oliver talked with one resident who was able to return home.
When you walk into the lobby, you immediately notice all of the stuff. It's piled high with everything from bags of pet food and toothbrushes to shampoo and stacks of blue jeans. It's everything that someone in this position would need, but it's still not home. Over at the front desk, Funny River resident Pamela Ferris is checking out.
Home, going home.
We walk outside. It's overcast and she's smiling. Sunny skies are usually welcome on the peninsula, but the light rain shower overnight was a big relief for displaced residents.
This morning I woke up, I was like, oh, thank you so much. And then it was waiting for the word, do we get to go back?
She hops into her black truck packed with suitcases and plastic bags. We drive about 14 miles out Funny River Road. The air is smokier and there are black burnt patches along the roadway. She pulls off into her driveway. There's no sign of the fire on her property.
Very happy to be home.
It's easy to see how happy she is looking at this place she left just a few days ago. She says she hopes the next few days bring more rain and the evacuation alert is also lifted. She says the chance of having to leave all over again is always in the back of her mind.
But with the rain and we just got to, you know, focus on moving forward and finishing up what we got to do here. And if it comes to that, it comes to that.
And more rain is in the forecast for the next few days. Reporting from Soldotna, I'm Shady Grove Oliver.
This weekend, Senator Mark Begich and Coast Guard Rear Admiral Thomas Ostebo made a brief appearance in the Aleutian Islands. As KUCB's Lauren Rosenthal reports, the officials shared their vision of how Unalaska and other coastal communities will have to support economic activity in the Arctic.
Senator Begich spent a good portion of his time in Unalaska at a public meeting with residents, but before he took any of their questions, he wanted to share some news.
Shell got good word on Thursday, that they are going to finish their EIS, the federal government will be, which is very important because that kind of dictates what they're going to do next. And that means more than likely they're going to be moving forward, hopefully next summer, in larger project development.
If Shell does go back to the Arctic and it's successful, Begich thinks that other oil companies will start working on their lease sites. That would mean more business and a lot of vessel traffic in Unalaska and other coastal towns in the state. Building infrastructure to meet that demand now could pay off down the road, but it's a gamble, and Begich says it's tough to build those docks and harbors to begin with.
So we just have to change the way we've been doing it, because in the past, it's just call the Corps or depend on the local government to do a revenue bond, or hopefully a state will give us a grant, all independent of each other.
He'd like to see some better coordination, but in the meantime, Begich is focusing on ways to tap into those existing resources, like a new bill, which lets Alaska compete for grants from the Army Corps of Engineers for small port projects. The program was originally designed for isolated ports, ones that are key for subsistence. Unalaska doesn't quite fit that description, but Begich says it will qualify for funding.
Some of the port areas here will be considered subsistence ports, and so they're a little different. Even though we see it as what it is, an industrial port, but because of the remoteness of it, it gives us some different classifications. That's why we wrote the language the way we did.
Unalaska's mayor, Shirley Marquardt, made a point of thanking Begich for that.
We've been hoping for a bill like that for several years with our projects port and the dredging, and when it was you who put in the wording that got that little window
just
of opening,
a little bit,
we cheered.
Smaller towns aren't the only ones struggling with this question of when and how much to grow in order to accommodate business in the Arctic. The Coast Guard's having a hard time, too. Rear Admiral Thomas Ostebo is getting ready to move to Washington, D.C. after serving as the Coast Guard's commander in Alaska.
People ask me all the time, what investments are we going to make? Are we going to build a hangar up in Barrow and a forward operating facility? And I'm like, if we need to, but we don't know if we need one until we know what's out there and what the play is going to look like.
Oil isn't the only factor at play. Dozens of cargo ships have already applied for permits to sail through melting ice on the Northern Sea Route this summer, above Russia. Ostebo says the Coast Guard is mostly focusing on preventing accidents there. Their big campaign is to get cargo traffic separated into lanes to cut down on the risk of a crash. But if there is a crash, or a grounding, or spill, Ostebo says the Coast Guard will get involved.
Our first thing is to get eyes on and to get situational awareness and then have the responsible party move. I think Dutch Harbor and Unalaska is going to be key to that. From a response step-off point, it's going to be the best refueling place for us. And if we could have better arrangements with our Russian counterparts on the other side, places like Anadyr would be very helpful.
Eventually, he says the Coast Guard will have to add more people and more equipment in Unalaska. For now, all they have is a marine safety unit of about a half dozen personnel. But it's costly to put so many of the Coast Guard's resources into the state. That's what Begich told constituents in Unalaska, and he meant it in more ways than one.
They have to stretch what they have. That means somewhere in the country, we're pulling something in order to do work up here, which is a growing area. So we know we need to add additional assets and equipment and staging capacity for the Coast Guard.
Begich took a shot at that this spring when he introduced legislation to set up bases in the Aleutian Islands and the Arctic, complete with air hangars and berthing for personnel. The bill ran out of steam pretty quickly, but it's probably not the last attempt to build out Alaska's coastline because of the Arctic's promise. And on Alaska, I'm Lauren Rosenthal.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, a Juneau student who had a tough road to graduation.
I've gotten to know my teachers so well that they probably know me better than I know myself sometimes, it feels like.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Doy Unlimited, Interior Alaska's regional native corporation, providing oil field services, government contracting, and natural resource development in Alaska and across the nation. Information at doyon.com. And by
Northern Air Cargo, providing year-round transportation of all types of freight, from vehicles and oversized equipment to small packages for corporations or small business. Northern Air Cargo, serving Alaska since 1956.
Remotely operated vehicles will be plying Prince William Sound and the Gulf of Alaska this summer, measuring acid levels. The float and glider vehicles are the latest technology deployed through a long-running monitoring project overseen by University of Alaska Fairbanks Ocean Acidification Research Center Director Jeremy Mathis.
The floats look like a surfboard that we can pilot around the ocean. And then additionally, we're deploying another instrument, something called a glider, that looks like a torpedo that you would shoot out of a submarine. And this instrument flies up and down in the water, so it goes from the surface all the way down to the bottom.
The battery and solar-powered ROVs will be at sea for 5 months, piloted by a technician in Seattle. The six-year study has shown acidification is increasing in the Gulf of Alaska and Prince William Sound. The change is caused by rising atmospheric carbon dioxide, which dissolves in the ocean and reduces carbonate available to creatures like crabs and shrimp to build and maintain their shells. Mathis says Alaska has an additional source of trouble, too, melting tidewater glaciers.
The glacier meltwater is having this dilution effect. And so we've seen places in Prince William Sound where the glacial meltwater is causing the concentrations of these carbonate minerals to be low enough to where if they were to encounter an organism that constructed a shell, the water may be corrosive to those animals.
Mathis says the next step in the project will be documenting the impact by checking for thinning shells. The Interior Gas Utility has laid out a plan for getting natural gas to thousands of homes in North Pole and other outlying areas of Fairbanks. As KUAC's Dan Bross reports, the nonprofit public utilities plan covers more than $200 million worth of work spread out over 6 years.
The Fairbanks North Star Borough-owned Interior Gas Utility, or IGU, plans to lay distribution pipe through neighborhoods outside the core area of Fairbanks where gas isn't currently available. IGU Board Chairman Bob Shefchik lists a yearly progression that calls for installing distribution lines from North Pole to Fox.
Predominantly residential heating areas and about 12,000 to 13,000 homes in the outlying areas of the borough.
Things will start with design work and right-of-way acquisition in North Pole this summer, with the actual laying of pipe beginning there in 2016. The entire IGU distribution system is estimated to cost between $230 and $260 million. It's one part of the state-led Interior Energy Project, which also includes construction of a gas processing plant on the North Slope and trucks to move the gas south, as well as local storage facilities. Shefchik says the utility will primarily rely on state financing to get started.
We expect that we'll cover at least the first 3 years of the build-out program, and then in years 4, 5, and 6, we would have to look at revenue bonds or some other financing mechanism.
Last fall, the IGU and Fairbanks Natural Gas competed for state certification to serve neighborhoods outside FNG's existing service realm in the core area of town. The IGU won, and FNG is focused on expanding distribution to more neighborhoods within its own area. But Shefchik says the IGU could contract with the private company to run its gas distribution system.
Oh, certainly, and we have talked to them. We expect to put out a RFP, and they're busy right now because they're building out the core of town, but we would hope that they propose as a potential operator.
The IGU anticipates having a 3-person staff and hiring others to largely run the utility. It's already contracted out business operations to MWH, the same energy company the state is partnering with on the North Slope gas processing plant. First gas is expected to reach Fairbanks by late 2015 or early 2016 at nearly half the cost per BTU of heating oil. In Fairbanks, I'm Dan Bross.
Golden Valley Electric Association lost one of its biggest customers last week, the Flint Hills Resources Refinery in North Pole. But GVEA is working on plans to hook up another industrial customer next year that will buy nearly as much electricity as did the refinery. KUAC's Tim Ellis reports.
The Air Force and GVEA are working on plans to connect Clear Air Force Station to the grid next year and shut down the 22.5 megawatt coal-fired power plant that's been generating electricity for the station since it was built in 1959. GVEA Vice President for Engineering Mike Wright says the Clear Station is now a GVEA member, and he says when it's connected to GVEA's system in the fall of next year, the Air Force will begin paying an estimated $5.2 million annually, which will offset most of what Flint Hills is now paying GVEA.
We lost about $2 to $3 million in revenue, so this is kind of filling that gap back up. So it's a positive thing for our ratepayers.
Wright says the big radar and other facilities at Clear will need an average of about 4 megawatts of power, with occasional peak loads of up to around 7 megawatts.
We just lost a refinery, which is about a 7 to 8 megawatt load, so this is fitting right into what we lost with the refinery.
Wright says GVEA ratepayers won't have to foot the bill to hook the station to the grid because next year the Air Force proposes to build a substation and 3-mile-long distribution line from GVEA's main transmission line that runs down the park's highway. He says because the Air Force is paying for those distribution facilities, GVEA is charging an effective rate of only about 15 cents per kilowatt hour. He says that's the same rate it charges for its other larger industrial customers.
There would be just a standard GS3 member that pays bills just like Pogo Mine would, or Fort Knox, Fort Greeley, ground-based missile defense. Others take power at this level.
The station commander at Clear couldn't comment about the plans because her higher headquarters, the Air Force Space Command, wouldn't authorize an interview. Wright says the Air Force must build a few other facilities before the station can connect to the grid, most importantly a steam heat plant, which would burn fuel oil. That's needed because the station is now being heated by steam generated by the power plant.
But once they put their new steam boiler in, they'll commission that, then they'll go on us for a while, then shortly thereafter they'll shut the plant down. I don't know what their plans are for decommissioning. That could be some point in the future. It could just sit there idle for quite a few years.
That's what members of the local chapter of the Federal Employees Union would like to see happen. Dawn Pierce is the legislative and political coordinator for American Federation of Government Employees Local 1836. Pierce says the local has long supported the idea of hooking the station up to GVEA, even though they have concerns about other parts of the plan, especially some of its cost estimates and assumptions. But Pierce says he and others oppose the Air Force's plan to decommission the power plant. Pierce, who works at Clear's power plant, says Local 1836 will continue to press its case with, among others, the state's congressional delegation to keep the power plant operational. In Fairbanks, I'm Tim Ellis.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Alyeska Pipeline Service Company, Alaska's pipeline to the future, delivering oil today, sustaining operations for tomorrow. If you're ready to quit tobacco or just thinking about it, the coaches at Alaska's Tobacco Quit Line, a free service for all Alaska adults, can support you with Text to Quit, with tools to make your quit attempt successful. Text to Quit helps you stay in touch with your quit coach, use nicotine replacement medications properly, manage those urges to use tobacco, and prevent relapses, all from your mobile phone. Call 1-800-QUIT-NOW. This message sponsored by the Alaska Tobacco Control Alliance.
Starting July 21st, farmers in Alaska can sign up for the U.S. Department of Agriculture's Reimbursement Transportation Cost Payment Program. Under the 2014 Farm Bill, farmers outside the contiguous United States can now receive a portion of the costs of shipping their agricultural products over long distances. The announcement of the new plan was made last Friday morning by USDA Farm Service Agency Administrator Juan Garcia. Danny Constantine is State Director of the USDA Farm Service Agency.
So this helps Alaska farmers with their costs, and it kind of helps level the playing field so that they can produce a crop and compete with some of the food that's being imported from the lower 48.
Constantine says Alaska's peony, hay, and barley growers will all benefit. Fish producers are not included in the plan, but oyster farmers in Southeast and Prince William Sound can take advantage of the program.
It helps all Alaska farmers, from the big farmers up in Delta growing hay and barley to the very smallest farmers growing vegetables for a farmer's market.
The reimbursement program also pays producers for the costs of buying supplies needed for planting at the start of the season. The benefits to producers are based on costs incurred each fiscal year, subject to an $8,000 cap. Reimbursements are usually paid back in spring, Constantine says. The ruling also affects Hawaii, Puerto Rico, Guam, American Samoa, and other islands far from the mainland U.S. The USDA will spend $1.8 million in transportation offset costs for producers enrolled in the program in the last year. A few fishermen from the communities in the Kuskokwim caught king salmon before the scheduled closures last week. In a typical year, the first catch is a time of joy, but this year it's bringing uncertainty. KYUK's Charles Enoch has more.
On May 20th, the lower Kuskokwim River was closed to targeted kingfishing. But before that, fishermen near the mouth of the river took advantage of an early run following an early breakup. Tuntutuliak elder Ron Simon was one of them. He says when he fished, he was thinking about other people he could distribute his catch with.
The people that fished before the closure were not only thinking about themselves, they also thought about other families or elders who don't have kings this year, since sharing is part of our way of life.
Simon caught fewer kings than he had hoped, but he did better than many others who said they caught nothing. He was also disappointed that he won't be able to go after more because of this year's heavy restrictions. He says these restrictions are hindering livelihoods for families in the surrounding villages.
What these people call regulations are changing our way of life to the point where we don't seem like Yupik people anymore.
Though the catch was meager, to say the least, another Tuntutuliak elder, Pat Pavila, says he gave away most of his catch.
We wanted to get plenty of kings, but we weren't that lucky. I caught three and gave two away.
Federal managers expect to provide villages with a traditional king salmon taste to allow many villages a small harvest proportionate to its population. But Tuntutuliak elder Henry Lupi says there's only so much you could do with a few fish.
I've heard of two kings that were caught. They tried to get it to as many people as possible. I had my share, but there's only so many families you could give it to with only two fish.
Most people don't know if the summer will provide enough food to last the winter. Many are hopeful for full chest freezers, while others fear fishing restrictions combined with low water could create pitnak, a Yupik word meaning a time of great need. In Bethel, I am Charles Enoch.
High school graduation is an accomplishment worth celebrating, but for some students, the achievement is that much sweeter because of the obstacles they had to overcome. KTOO's Casey Kelly profiles a graduate of Juneau's Alternative High School who's been living on her own for about a year.
One of the first things you notice about Kendall Roberts are her piercings, a stud in her left eyebrow and two rings in her lower lip. She's also got dyed hair, though what was supposed to be purple ended up kind of orange.
It reflects who I am. Like, I really believe in self-expression, and any way you can find that is cool with me.
Kendall is 17, likes roller derby, art, all kinds of music, and hanging out with friends. She seems pretty well adjusted, considering her life has been anything but. Her parents split up when she was five. She and her mom moved to Juneau and lived for a while with her aunt. She says her mom went through a series of bad relationships, some of which rubbed off on her.
I started going through different abusive relationships, abusive in any sort of way.
She started acting out and got suspended a number of times in elementary school. When she was 10, she went to live with her dad for a year in Oregon, but things did not improve. After moving back to Juneau, Kendall says she developed a substance abuse problem and was in and out of rehab. She was never homeless, but says there were times she felt unsafe at home and ran away.
I was lucky enough to have family members take me in when I needed a place to stay, and I stayed with my grandparents and my aunt for months at a time just to be able to get stable.
Last year, Kendall struck out on her own and got approved to live in a transitional apartment provided by Juneau Youth Services. She works two jobs and pays 30% of her income for rent. She meets with JYS staff once a week.
They help us in any way we need. If we're going through a tough situation or we don't know how to, for example, if someone didn't know how to do their laundry, they would teach them how to do that.
Kendall says she needs the most help with the financial aspect of living by herself. She lives in a two-bedroom apartment with a roommate and says they lead a pretty normal life.
When I come home from work, we'll cook dinner, have a meal together, do chores together, you know, hang out afterwards together, and it's just great.
She says she never fit in at Juno Douglas High School, where she went as a freshman and sophomore. She says she was bullied and always felt ashamed of herself. This year, she transferred to Yakusuke Dakihiti Alternative High School, where she found a community that embraced her.
I've gotten to know my teachers so well that they probably know me better than I know myself sometimes, it feels like. And I feel like everybody at this school really sticks together, even if they're not from the same, like, friend group.
Yakus counselor Kelly Neiman says Kendall has grown tremendously in her year at the school.
Kendall is a student who has overcome a lot of personal challenges and obstacles in her life, in her home life, and just a highly motivated student who's really turned her life around.
Principal Kristen Garreau says it's really rewarding to watch a student like Kendall succeed.
She is really in a place where she's ready to go to college. She has a place to live. She has people who know her and are connected with her, and that's just a really great thing to see.
Even though this was supposed to be her junior year, Kendall took enough independent study classes to graduate early. She says her main motivation was wanting to spend more time at one of her jobs as a teacher's assistant with Gold Creek Child Development Center. She plans to continue working there while she goes to college. She wants to earn degrees in special education and occupational therapy.
I work with many children that have special needs, and so that kind of inspired me to do everything in my capability of helping another person.
As for her personal life, Kendall says she's happy. She's going to visit her dad in a few weeks and says her relationship with her mom has never been better.
I probably just needed not to live with her for a little bit extra space, but I go to her about everything. I talk to her at my worst times. I call her just to say, I'm having a great day. I've got some good news. You know, how's your day?
Kendall will continue living at the JYS Transitional Living Apartment as she starts college at the University of Alaska Southeast. She says she still has her struggles, but knows she has people to lean on when times are tough. In Juneau, I'm Casey Kelly.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. We had reports tonight from Shady Grove Oliver in Kenai, Lauren Rosenthal in Unalaska, Dan Ross in Fairbanks, Tim Ellis in Delta, Charles Enoch in Bethel, and Casey Kelly in Juneau. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. Josh Edge is our web producer. I'm Ellen Lockyer.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
BP Alaska. As part of their commitment to Alaska, BP and their employees are investing in over 400 education and service organizations in communities across the state. More at alaska.bp.com. Alaska Mental Health Trust beneficiaries are important members of our workforce, from healthcare facilities and nonprofit organizations to retail stores and restaurants. Alaskans who are in recovery or experience developmental disabilities, traumatic brain injuries, or mental health conditions are succeeding in the workplace. The Trust encourages businesses to consider ways in which employing trust beneficiaries can be good for business. Learn more at mhtrust.org. This message sponsored by the Alaska Mental Health Trust. May is National Bike Safety Month. Alaskans are riding their bikes to school, work, and play. Motorists, be on the lookout for bikes and pedestrians. Bicyclists, follow the rules of the road. All riders should wear a fitted helmet and use reflectors and safety lights to be seen no matter what time of day. Go to injuryprevention.alaska.gov for safety tips. This message sponsored by the Alaska Highway Safety Office and the Alaska Department of Health and Social Services.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.